B&T Satellite only does satellite dishes. It's a fact. B&T Satellite makes TV easy. And now Doug's making Starlink Internet easy, too. Starlink Internet is often the only way to get connected, especially if you game, stream, or work from home. Most often, there's several devices connected to your Internet at one time, and that requires a great Internet connection. B&T Satellite is your choice for Starlink Internet, and now Starlink installation and setup. Call B&T Satellite for your Internet installation today, 241-3474. You'll always get the best Dish TV and DirecTV packages from B&T Satellite. But did you know Doug can set up your smart home devices, including cameras? Just call Doug at B&T Satellite, 241-3474. Don't call the 800 number. Call B&T Satellite today, 241-3474. For your home custom theater installation, for TV wall mounts, smart home devices, and everything satellite and Internet, Doug makes satellite easy. Doug makes Internet easy. Doug makes TV easy. Call B&T Satellite, 241-3474.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
And the response of these great minds in journalism, at journalism schools, and at these newspapers is, I have an idea. Let's take the thing that we've been doing that has caused a cratering of trust, and let's do much more of it. And I don't know how you reason with these people.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief at The Federalist, Fox News contributor, and author of the recent book, Rigged. She joins us to talk in-depth about a recent report from a House committee on election integrity in 2022, also what to expect from the House majority in 2023, and the current state of journalism. Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here with you.
We're going to start our conversation today with a continuation of the themes in Rigged and election integrity. The House Election Integrity Caucus has recently released a report on the midterms and their findings inside, some praise for some states, some criticisms for others, and recommendations. So the praise first, Texas, Florida, Georgia, all had good things said about them in this House Election Integrity Caucus report. Georgia specifically, we were told, is Jim Crow 2.0. None of those fears came to pass during this midterm.
So when Georgia made some minor improvements to their election laws, yes, all heck broke loose. You had President Biden asking corporations to engage in an economic boycott of the state. Some of them did. Major League Baseball pulled its all-star baseball game by kowtowing to what President Biden asked them to do. Other corporations got involved, saying that if you improved the election laws in that state, that that would be the equivalent of Jim Crow 2.0. This was always a horrible thing to say because Jim Crow was a real way to disenfranchise real voters. It was a horrible thing that the country worked very hard to get through and overcome. Improving election security, particularly in an age of mass unsupervised voting, is actually an important thing that helps people get along and helps people accept election results and feel confident in their elections. And so to compare those two things was really, really a horrible thing to do. But as it turned out, these minor improvements to their election laws, and I would say that Georgia has a long way to go to improve them even more, they resulted in shorter wait times, much greater voter satisfaction. Mm-hmm. A recent poll showed that literally they couldn't find anybody who had a problem with the voting, despite what Biden and many people in the media had said.
Isn't it weird or a little odd that in a state in which Joe Biden and many Democrats say is racist and suppressing votes, they now want that state to be among the first to decide the nominee for president on the Democratic side?
Yeah, there's not a lot of consistency here in what they're saying about this being some horrific place where voting is not going well. But also, we want that to be a state that determines who the nominee is.
Florida now has a national reputation of doing things very well, counting votes very quickly. One of the recommendations in the report was about the processing and counting of mail-in ballots or early ballots before Election Day. They do that in Florida. There are other states in which they don't. Actually, Michigan is one of them, where they don't touch the ballots until after the election is done, after Election Day is over. Would you recommend or do you think it's a good idea for more states to look at the Florida model for how they handle? If early voting is going to happen, which apparently it is for the foreseeable future, is the Florida model a better way to handle those early votes?
Clearly, the Florida model is better in that it's a large state with many millions of people, and they know what the outcome of the election is within an hour or two after polls close on election day. You compare that with a place like Maricopa County in Arizona, which is where 62% of the population lives, and that county doesn't even know how many people voted, much less who they voted for many, many days. Mm-hmm. That's just a mess, and it's not a way to inspire confidence in election results. The problem seems to be, though, in what is happening in how votes are being processed and how much oversight there can be. And different states have different laws that affect these things. What's most important is that there is consistency across counties in any pre-election day tabulation of ballots. You know, in Pennsylvania, they had problems because you'd have these Democrat-leaning areas, contrary to state law, going through ballots before, or the ballot envelopes before mm-hmm. election day, and curing them, fixing them. And this provided a systematic advantage to Democrat voters in Pennsylvania that was not given to Republican voters because in Republican the law before election day. And what it should be, you want to be consistent. And then there are other things I just want to say about Florida that are really great, including, you know, they obviously have impressive candidates across the political spectrum, and they have interesting things happening with their policy. But the Republican Party there also engages in ballot accountability. Mm-hmm. They know who has been sent a mail-out ballot and when that has come back in. They can track these things. It helps with their get-out-the-vote efforts, and it's not something that just the Democrat Party is doing. The Democrat Party does it nationwide, but in Florida, Republicans do it as well.
There's arguments from some on the right after this November election that Republicans have to get better at essentially the ballot harvesting that Democrats have been involved with now for some cycles and encourage in some areas. Is that a proper response to what we saw this past cycle?
Let me just say, I personally oppose any early, massive early voting. I think it's bad for the country. I agree with Attorney General Barr, who said that it's good to go through an election campaign at the same time, vote on the same day, have the results on the same day. I think that's a much healthier way to be. But so long as most of the country disagrees with me, and they do, and they have these long periods of early voting, it is insane to me that the Republican Party has not invested in tracking those ballots. Ballot harvesting is technically illegal in some states, legal in others. So that's a loaded term. But what they have to do is understand that the old ways of convincing voters to have enough energy and enthusiasm to show up on election day, that's just dead. What the Democrat Party is doing is taking frequently low-information voters. They may not even know that there's an election or who's running or what the issues are. It sort of doesn't matter to them. They just put people on top of a group of these uninformed voters. They make sure they register to vote. They make sure they ask for a ballot. They make sure they turn it in. The Republican Party is relying on old-timey persuasion like it's the 1980s, and they're not thinking in terms of ballots. They're thinking in terms of people. That might be better for the Republic, but it's a surefire way to lose elections.
So I thought about this a lot after November. Are we moving toward a time when candidate quality, which we heard so much about after November, becomes less and less important because we are voting for, at least right now, and the party. We are voting for an R. We are voting for a D. We don't care what happens the last 4 weeks of the election cycle because our vote is cast. We vote for the party, not for the person.
Scott, if you had any doubt about it before, I think the 2022 election leaves no other option. It truly does not matter who the candidate is. If you have one of these ballot operations, it doesn't matter what the issues are. You know, the polls in the 2022 midterms actually weren't off that much. They said that Republicans were going to win by significant majorities in terms of the aggregate vote. That happened. They won nationwide by several points. People are very frustrated with the state of the economy, with all sorts of policy decisions that Democrats have been making, but it didn't matter because of these ballot moving operations in key areas that made it so that the mood of the electorate just didn't matter. But if you look at Senator John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, someone who was unable to articulate sentences because of a stroke he had, if you look at Joe Biden, who campaigned from his basement in 2020 and was really not up to the rigors of a presidential campaign, and we all kind of see what that looks like now, It's just clearly not true that candidate quality matters.
Talking with Molly Hemingway here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. She is Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief at The Federalist, Fox News contributor. Her most recent book is Rigged. You can find her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. When we come back, more with Molly about what to expect from the Republican majority in the U.S. House in 2023 and questions and comments on the state of journalism today. In the meantime, head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu. Click on the Affiliates tab. You'll find radio stations airing this program all across the country. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to the people, but not to Congress, is the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today, we Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve liberty, we must recultivate the freedom-loving spirit of our founding fathers. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
For more information, visit hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Chandler, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on the continuing relevance of the Constitution.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century so long ago. And some of it does read sort of quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9, for example. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges for partisan reasons. This strikes at the rule of law, the rule under which we're all to be treated the same. The crony capitalism so common today, where the government gives favors and tax dollars to some businesses and advantages over others, is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. The Constitution is not outdated at all.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. Go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly, but consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
The word education comes from a Latin word that means to lead forth. Forth is a value-laden term. It raises a question. Which way is forth? How do you know you're going in the right direction? The easy answer in our time is it just depends on which way you want to go. Young people almost always say that today. They've been taught to say that. But that's the wrong answer. At Hillsdale College, we understand education to be the pursuit of the highest answer to that question. Discovering the right way by reading the greatest books by the greatest minds in history. Coming to see the meaning of three ultimate and related things: the good, the true, and the beautiful. This is the way forth. This is education.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief for The Federalist, Fox News contributor. Molly, we talked in the last segment about election integrity. Let's talk moving forward about what to expect from the U.S. House, the Republican House majority this year in 2023. What do you think are reasonable expectations that we should look for from the House majority, considering the makeup of the House, considering the slim majority that Republicans have in the House, at least for the next 2 years? What good can be done with that margin?
On the one hand, there's almost nothing they can do. On the other hand, all that matters is that they have the majority. Mm-hmm. Simply controlling these committees and being able to do any basic oversight is a huge victory, in part because it stops what was happening previously, which were, you know, massive cover-ups of what was going on in the executive branch or politicized operations. And so I think it is reasonable to expect some answers on all sorts of things, such as the government's involvement in suppressing freedom of speech and debate and election meddling with big tech companies, telling big tech companies, you know, how to silence the free speech rights of Americans, whether it's about COVID-19 or any number of other things that they were engaged in. You know, it's just also important, though, that President Biden accept the results of the 2022 elections and realize that Republicans did win the House. He has to work with them in some sense. Obviously, Democrats still control the Senate. So, again, there's a limit to what can be done. Mm-hmm. But they can definitely get some issues out there and information out there, use their subpoena authority, and use the power of the purse to hold up things as much as possible until they get the proper answers.
You and I both work in the journalism department here at Hillsdale, and I saw this op-ed from a little bit ago in the Washington Post, headlined, "Newsrooms that move beyond objectivity can build trust." So this is Leonard Downey Jr., former executive editor for the Washington Post, and now a professor at the Journalism School at Arizona State University. I thought it might be interesting just to read some sections from this piece and get your response. He talked to editors, news leaders around the country. Kathleen Carroll, a former executive editor at the Associated Press, she says, quote, "It's objective by whose standard? That standard seems to be white, educated, fairly wealthy. And when people don't feel like they find themselves in news coverage, it's because they don't fit that definition." When did the standard begin that people needed to find themselves in news coverage for it to be effective, objective, truthful?
It's an interesting question, but it is true that we have had a massive change in the American model of journalism. It was never objective. I will acknowledge that. It was never... we were always dealing with really major problems of bias, and Republicans have been complaining about that since literally Dwight Eisenhower. So it's a problem that goes way back. But other groups also complain about it. But something happened in recent years where they went from aiming toward objectivity, understanding the need to try to present multiple sides present multiple viewpoints, into just being all-out propagandists. And it does seem like we have just completely lost the plot within the last 10 years, and that the vast majority of major corporate media are engaged in propaganda and pushing of narrative rather than articulating facts. And facts are not, you know, I mean, what this piece was saying was basically like factual reporting is something that people who aren't white don't value. And that is such a racist and horrible thing to say when it benefits all humans to have facts reported and, you know, accurate information conveyed so that we can all make good decisions.
The piece by Downey, this is Downey's words, "In today's diversifying newsrooms, reporters feel it negates many of their own identities, life experiences, and cultural contexts, keeping them from pursuing truth in their work. There was once an idea that the reporter shouldn't be a part of the story, should be telling the reader or the viewer or the listener about what was happening. Now the injection of yourself into the story is something new."
That's new and annoying and all sorts of things. But it is, again, true that if you were to report accurately and factually about certain things, it does come right up against this new identity wave. So if you were to report actually about, or if you're to report the truth about biological reality, that, you know, that your sex is what it is and it's not something based on feelings, and if you were to report that, you know, just basic scientific facts, that is at odds with a lot of what we are being asked to accept by the new form, the new media regime.
There's a quote from Los Angeles Times, Kevin Merida, who says he's open to the possibility that reporters might cover issues on which they actively engage. Quote, we're trying to find that line. We're trying to create an environment in which we don't police our journalists too much. Our young people want to be participants in the world. There was a reporter, was it Kate Smith, who moved from CBS covering abortion issues to Planned Parenthood, advocating for abortion issues. And as she was working for CBS, it was quite clear what she was advocating for. This sounds like what he's saying is we'd like more of that. If you're involved in advocating for an issue outside of our newsroom, you should cover that issue for us as well.
They're saying this. All these people who are quoted are saying this in an environment where almost nobody reports any confidence in what the media are saying. If you ask Americans, we're talking single digits in some groups, report any confidence whatsoever that the news is being reported fairly, accurately, or honestly. And the response of these great minds in journalism, at journalism schools and at these newspapers is, I have an idea. Let's take the thing that we've been doing that has caused a cratering of trust and let's do much more of it. And I don't know how you reason with these people. On the other hand, I am really glad for the clarity of them just admitting that they are not in journalism. They're in propaganda and narrative shaping. We are in an information war, and people who care about the Republic need to understand the threat posed by this type of propaganda approach to journalism, and they need to make sure they are investing in fighting it, in rejecting it, not allowing these people to shape what we talk about.
Many younger, or at least some, I don't want to be too harsh, but younger journalists see journalism as advocacy. And when they report, they report from a position of advocacy. They want to see an outcome happen. And no one seems to want to change their minds that that's not the way to do it.
Well, but there's also a weakness in not realizing that that's what's going on. So you have an entire army of well-funded, corporate-funded media figures who are engaged in nonstop advocacy and information operations. All they do is work to fight, you know, the nomination of a conservative Supreme Court justice, or to make up stories about the Republican presidential candidate or mayor or, you know, gubernatorial candidate. And on the other side, you have a bunch of people who are like, I have an idea. Let's try to report fairly and accurately and honestly, and nobody will pay attention to it. And so I do think this is a challenge for people who care about not letting the country be controlled by these left-wing activists who, I think, have a lot of negative results for the country, how to fight them. And if you are disarming yourself when you just say, let's try this 1950s approach of aiming toward objectivity and not understanding that we are in an information war and that that's what's grabbing people's attention.
Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief at The Federalist, Fox News contributor, and the most recent book is Rigged. Molly, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Brent Klein from Hillsdale's English Department as he returns for his series on Cormac McCarthy. We talk about The Crossing. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Not one penny. This is how much funding Hillsdale College receives from the government. Not even indirectly in the form of student loans or grants. Not one penny. There are thousands of colleges and universities in the U.S. The vast majority receive around 30% of their revenue from government funding, loans, and grants. In other words, these schools are dependent on the government to stay in business. And they receive more than $150 billion per year from taxpayers to do so. In contrast, Hillsdale refuses all government funding. Why? The answer is simple. Money from the government comes with strings attached. Do's and don'ts, restrictions and mandates that in small but significant ways influence how a school operates and educates. But from the very beginning in 1844, Hillsdale has been committed to providing a world-class education that upholds America's founding principles and preserves the blessings of civil and religious liberty. Therefore, everything Hillsdale does, from the private loans, grants, and scholarships it provides to 97% of its students, to the completely free online courses it offers to millions across the country, depends on generous donors who recognize how much independence is worth. Not one penny safeguards the college's mission. Not one penny preserves the quality and integrity of a Hillsdale education. Not one penny ensures that Hillsdale can continue to be a beacon of independence for all of its students on campus and across America.
For more information about Hillsdale College, visit hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Learning is hard work. Hard work requires character. Learning begins in faith. It must move upward toward the highest thing, unseen at the beginning, God. And freedom is essential to learning. Its principles must be studied and defended. Learning, character, faith, and freedom, these are the inseparable purposes of Hillsdale College.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out our show via Apple Podcasts and leave a review to help others find the program. We're joined now by Dr. Brent Klein, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, Scott.
Continue with our series on Cormac McCarthy. We're in the middle of his Border Trilogy. This time we talk about The Crossing, released in 1994. What's the significance of the book's title?
There are a lot of crossings. Yeah. I mean, literal. Yeah. There are literal crossings from the United States, and once again, we're going from the United States. This time, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. We're going from New Mexico into Mexico, Old Mexico, several different times at different stages of Billy Parham's life, from the age of 16 to 17. Though it feels like stages of life from young man to old man, because he's going to have quite the wild experiences. This book is different. This book is different than All the Pretty Horses. And that, for that reason, this is sometimes people's least favorite of the Border Trilogy. And I promise I'm not trying to be a contrarian here by saying this is my favorite book of the Border Trilogy. It's, if you liked All the Pretty Horses and it has that sort of, that clopping speed of being on a horse and you're moving along and everything is sort of external and there's a lot of action, and then you're going to come to The Crossing and you're like, oh my gosh, we're spending 100 pages on him trapping wolves. But this is another one of the crossings. You have the crossing, the physical crossing into Mexico, but you also have a kind of metaphysical crossing. And I would say that this book, of all three of the Border Trilogy, certainly, maybe of his entire catalog, is the most philosophical, is the most metaphysical. You can't use the word religious with Cormac McCarthy. He's not doctrinally religious in any kind of way, but he is very much concerned about the metaphysical, mm-hmm. and Billy Parham is going to experience it. So you're having a physical crossing, but you're also having an almost spiritual crossing as well.
It's your favorite. Tell us a little bit about the characters. What should we know about them going in?
So this is the story of Billy Parham, who's also going to be 16 years old, like John Grady was 16 years old. And it's going to follow him for over a year. He's going to be 17 before it's over. And it's his family who has moved very close to the border in order to do some ranching. And this is a very episodic book. It's in parts. And so the first part of this book is going to be about Billy on his own returning this wolf that he has caught back to Mexico. The wolf it's a she-wolf who has pups. She's still pregnant with pups. And so there's this sense of more wolves are coming, and they're marauding his father's cattle. And when he finally traps it, he has the opportunity to kill it. But he has been told that there's something special about the wolf, and he has experienced this himself. I mean, what really sort of sets up the crossing as a text is that first story that Billy has is, does it actually happen? He sees wolves in the middle of the night, and it's not clear whether that actually happens. He wakes up in the middle of the night and sees wolves, or it's just sort of a vision, because he's going to be told that the wolf is sort of an avenue to this sort of metaphysical world. And Billy seems to experience that as he encounters this wolf and he returns her to Mexico and sort of has this adventure, and that's going to end. And then you're going to have a complete left turn, a very tragic left turn. And you're going to say, well, what happened to the wolf? And you're thinking, well, the wolf is still there symbolically. The wolf is still there thematically, as now Billy and his younger brother Boyd once again return to Mexico. Their parents are, I'm going to give something away here, but their parents are tragically killed, and they return to Mexico to find the horses that the horse thieves have taken. And so this book, you're going to be at page 300 and you're like, where's the wolf? And the wolf is in the margins, but as they're finding what the horse is, as they're finding what Mexico is, much like John Grady is, or like much like John Grady did, you're going to have that experience of like, what is true here? Does the wolf, does the horse, does Mexico give us access to a kind of truth that we wouldn't have otherwise had? And again, this is a sort of crossing they're experiencing.
Are these characters hard for the reader to get a handle on? You mentioned in one of our previous conversations that sometimes we feel, reading McCarthy, that the narrator should know things, but the narrator doesn't know things. So how do we come to know our characters here in The Crossing?
Yeah, I do think that's something to bear in mind, is you have to... can I bring up The Simpsons?
Sure.
There's a great moment in The Simpsons where Lisa is at a jazz bar, and she's listening to the jazz, and there's a guy sitting there at the bar, and the guy's like, I don't like it. And she's like, well, you have to listen to the notes she's not playing. And the guy's like, well, I can do that at home. It's a great line as a non-jazz guy. I get that. But I'm actually saying that kind of thing here, because you're going to have to look for what's not said, because the narrator doesn't, if you're reading a 19th century Dickens novel or something like that, and there's a paragraph on what the character is thinking, McCarthy's cutting that out. So I would tell you, the first time I ever read The Crossing, I did not see the amount of guilt that Billy Parham carries with him. And because it doesn't say Billy felt guilty or anything like that, you see it in the very subtle lines. There's a sentence that gets repeated throughout the book, which is Billy telling his younger brother Boyd, just go to sleep. Just go to sleep. And reading this is like, oh, this is like, I don't know what to do here. I need you to just be quiet, because I can't handle this. And so to look for what's not said as much as what's said, which I know seems like a silly academic thing or jazz thing to do, but it really is. McCarthy is interested in a character psychology as is expressed through their subtle and overt actions, not so much for a narrator doing that work for us. And that's very much going to be the case in The Crossing here.
The themes of hospitality or kindness in The Crossing, what role do they play? Do they juxtapose a bit with some of the more violent scenes in the book?
This is true of The Crossing, and I think you can say this of all of McCarthy's works. They are violent books, but they are, you remember that violence, and people always talk about that violence. But there are moments of indescribable kindness in these books as well. And that, there's the kindness of a doctor waking up in the middle of the night to go save someone and not taking any pay. There's the kindness of a peasant who gives some of their last tortillas away. There's also the just much more banal kindness to a stranger of giving directions or these sort of like life-affirming and civilization-affirming moments. I mentioned earlier that, you know, the Mexican Revolution sort of, I think, is latent in all of the Border Trilogy, and these are, especially in The Crossing, it has left a ruined Mexico. Because one thing we should point out is The Crossing is the second book in the trilogy, mm-hmm. but it's the first book chronologically. So Billy is older than John Grady, so since they're both occurring when they're 16 years old, the book The Crossing takes place in the 1930s, and then All the Pretty Horses in 1949. That in the 1930s, we're just a decade after some horrifying war in Mexico, the Mexican Revolution. These are ruined people, and they're still offering in the form of ejido, which is sort of a commune, or just in the form of yes, I will get you to safety as quick as I can. And I think when you think about the violence that's, yes, that is sometimes bothersome in McCarthy, it's always present among kindness. This is not just man will be wolf to man, no pun intended with this book, and destroy someone. But maybe man will be wolf to man, because in this book, wolf means sort of access to something greater mm-hmm. than just the sort of carnal needs or greeds that a person might have.
We'll get to talk next time once again about both the main characters from both of our previous two books as we talk about Cities of the Plain. Dr. Brent Klein, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, as we discuss The Crossing, the second of the Border Trilogy from Cormac McCarthy. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Up next, we'll hear excerpts from a Hillsdale lecture by Scott Stewart, Mississippi Solicitor General, who defended that state's law in the Dobbs v. Jackson case at the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to the people, but not to Congress, is the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today, we Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve liberty, we must recultivate the freedom-loving spirit of our founding fathers. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
For more information, visit hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844. Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly. but consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
We all have a common problem. How do you live well?
What is the right thing for government to do?
What makes a good children's story? It's what makes a good story.
Why is the serpent's punishment to crawl on its belly when that's what it does?
It took 65 million deaths to prove what should have been self-evident.
It's time to pull back and recall the big picture.
We were made to know the best things and to live in light of them. Let's begin.
Learn more about Hillsdale's online courses at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We now hear excerpts from a lecture given by Scott Stewart, Mississippi Solicitor General, who represented the state in the Dobbs v. Jackson case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Stewart spoke at a Constitution Day celebration for Hillsdale in September of 2022 on the Dobbs case. He begins by introducing the first of three fundamental questions about the case. Should the decision on abortion be left to the people?
The fundamental constitutional question. What issues does the Constitution leave to the people, and what issues does it take away from the people? And in Dobbs itself, does the Constitution leave the hard issue of abortion to the people, or does it take that issue away from the people? Mississippi's view here is straightforward. Under our Constitution, the people decide almost every important issue. The Constitution was ratified by and for the people. In ratifying the Constitution, the people held on to most of the power. They gave some of the power to the federal government, but they retained most of the power for themselves and their elected state representatives. Now, the Constitution does take some issues away from the people in the states. The best known are in the Bill of Rights. States can't abridge the freedom of speech, infringe the right to keep and bear arms, or search your home without a very good reason. But most powers stay with the people, acting through their elected state representatives. That's the basic setup of our constitutional system. And the fundamental question in a constitutional case is whether the Constitution leaves an issue to the people or instead takes it away from the people. Is the issue one for the democratic process, or is it carved out of that process? That was fundamentally the question before the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade, and the court held in Roe that the Constitution largely takes abortion away from the people. The state's argument in Dobbs is that Roe got that fundamental question wrong. The Constitution leaves abortion to the people and the democratic process. The argument for that is, again, straightforward. To begin, nothing in the Constitution protects a right to abortion. The Constitution's words, its text, doesn't expressly protect any such right. We know what it looks like when the Constitution expressly protects a right. That's what the First Amendment does. So the question becomes whether abortion is one of those few rights that the Constitution doesn't mention but still protects. This is done through the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment protects due process of law. Over its history, the Supreme Court has held that due process protects certain rights that aren't mentioned in the Constitution, but are fundamental. Only a few rights fall in that category, and the Supreme Court is very careful about saying that a right does fall into that category, for two reasons. First, when the court recognizes a constitutional right, it largely removes the issue from the democratic process. As I've said, that's not the norm under our Constitution. And second, when judges consider rights that aren't mentioned in the Constitution, they don't have a lot to go on. So the risk is unusually strong that they'll find new rights just because they happen to like them.
Stewart continues addressing the second fundamental question. What should a court do when it sees that a past decision is wrong?
When should the court overrule precedent, and when should it let it stand? The court has a policy of standing by past decisions. The policy is known as stare decisis. The idea behind stare decisis is that standing by past decisions generally serves the rule of law. It fosters stability, predictability, and continuity. It promotes the view that the court is governed by law rather than by the views of its current members. It encourages restraint, humility. It respects reliance interests. But no one on the Supreme Court believes that stare decisis is an ironclad command. All justices think that the court should overrule precedent some of the time. And some of the court's greatest decisions have overruled precedent. But the court is very careful about overruling. It is said that overruling demands a special justification. That usually means that the past decision must be not only wrong, but egregiously wrong. That the past decision has caused severe damage, and that overruling the past decision won't unduly upset reliance interests. So what were the arguments for overruling Roe and Casey? Mississippi made several, but our position was fundamentally this. A decision does not get more wrong or more damaging than Roe and Casey. Start with how wrong Roe and Casey are. It's not just that they recognize a right that has no basis in the Constitution. It's worse. Roe and Casey adopt a unique right, a right to end a human life. Nowhere else does the court recognize such a right. Nowhere else does a right to privacy, liberty, dignity, or autonomy mean a right to take a life. Think about a right to marry, a right to intimacy between consenting adults, a right to contraception. The court has recognized all those rights, and none of them involves taking a life. So abortion is fundamentally different, and that makes Roe and Casey wrong in a way that's fundamentally worse than other wrong decisions. Now take the damage that Roe and Casey have caused. Look at what they've done. Roe and Casey undermine democratic government. As I've said, the Constitution leaves most important issues to the people. Roe and Casey upended that. They blocked the people from deciding one of the most important issues we face. Roe and Casey plagued our country. Abortion is already hard. Roe and Casey just made it worse.
We're listening to Scott Stewart, Mississippi Solicitor General, speaking in September of 2022 at a Hillsdale Constitution Day celebration on the Dobbs v. Jackson case. Here, Stewart begins to discuss the controversy surrounding the case.
Abortion is like nothing else. It's unique for women. It's unique for unborn children. It's unique for us as a society. Abortion is hard because there are interests on both sides, and only one side can prevail. In the time I have left, I'd like to reflect on that controversy and suggest what we might take away from it. In my view, the controversy around Dobbs draws out three key points. It presents a challenge, it brings an opportunity, and ultimately, it shows why Dobbs is such a great decision. I'll address each of these. First, the controversy around Dobbs presents a challenge for our country and our Constitution. Because abortion presents unique competing interests, some controversy is inevitable, even healthy. But the controversy around Dobbs goes well beyond that. I'm not talking about the many people of goodwill on both sides who have strong views and just voice them forcefully. I'm talking about people who do harm when they know better. I'm talking about people who know what our Constitution is, what our judiciary is, how vital they are, yet act to destroy them. I don't have to describe all that happened these past few months. We all saw it, and we know how bad much of it was. It reveals a darkness. The darkness lies in a warped view. It's warped in many ways, but I'll focus on one. It's a warped view of the Supreme Court. It's the view that it's the court's job to decide, for all of us, the most important issues we face as a society. And not just decide those issues, but decide them a certain way. To pick winners and losers, even when the Constitution does not pick winners and losers. That is not the Supreme Court's role. The court's role is to stand strong and stand firm for constitutional principle, no matter what, even when it means disappointing millions of people.
Wrapping up, Scott Stewart, Mississippi Solicitor General, tells us why Dobbs is a great decision.
I want to talk about the result. Yes, it gets the Constitution and the law right. But its greatness rests on something more. And the controversy around the case helps show why Dobbs is a great decision. I'll give two reasons. The first reason. The controversy shows why the Constitution leaves abortion to the people and why the Supreme Court in Dobbs was right to return it to the people. Because abortion is so hard and so important, the Supreme Court was never going to bring peace to the issue by holding on to it. The last 50 years showed that. The court had controlled abortion since Roe, and things only got worse. The Constitution's framers understood that things wouldn't work if unelected judges control policy. So the framers kept most power with the people. They knew that people are imperfect, but they also knew that the people are our best hope. So the Constitution places its trust in the people. Dobbs is a great decision because it honors that core feature of our Constitution. The second reason, Dobbs is a great decision because the controversy around it made it hard. Great things are always hard and controversial in their time. The battle for American independence, the fight against slavery, the struggle for civil rights, these were all fraught, hard, and controversial. We now see them as the greatest moments for our country. Easy things are not great. No one remembers them, no one celebrates them. And in Dobbs, in the face of scorching controversy, on the hardest of issues, the greatest thing the Supreme Court could have done was to set the law right and enforce the Constitution. And it did that. The court did the right thing when the right thing was hard.
That was Scott Stewart, Mississippi Solicitor General, who represented the state in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dobbs v. Jackson case, speaking in September of 2022 at a Hillsdale Constitution Day celebration. You can find the entire lecture on our Freedom Library page. That's freedomlibrary.hillsdale.edu. That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Molly Hemingway, Brent Klein from Hillsdale's English Department, and also we heard from Scott Stewart, Mississippi Solicitor General. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at radiohour.hillsdale.edu or wherever you listen to podcasts. The assistant producer of the show is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons, an independent senior living community. I'm excited to share with you an exclusive program we are currently offering at River Commons called our Moderate Income Program. This is an in-house program offered by Raystone Senior Living. Those who financially qualify for this program will receive a reduced monthly rate. This rate still includes all of our regular services and amenities. Included in the monthly rent are 3 chef-prepared meals daily, weekly housekeeping and linen services, scheduled transportation, activities, utilities, cable TV, an emergency medical pendant, and more. Our community also has a very friendly family feel, all set on beautiful grounds with scenic views. To learn more about our moderate income program, schedule a tour, or lunch plus a tour, please give us a call at 530-221-2121. You can also visit us on our web at river-commons.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
Satisfy your cravings with Roliberto's Taco Shop at the corner of California and Placer in downtown Reading. Enjoy breakfast burritos from 9 a.m. to noon for only $6.99. And don't miss Taco Tuesday. Choose from chicken, beef, or ground beef tacos for only $2.25 each. Roliberto's Taco Shop also offers burritos, taco salads, and delicious combination plates, including 2 crispy tacos, a taco and enchilada, taco and tostada, carne asada, fajitas, and more at Roliberto's Taco Shop at 1701 California Street in downtown Reading. Mention you heard this ad on KCNR and receive a free taco between 6 and 9 p.m. Open Monday through Wednesday 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. Thursday through Saturday 9 a.m. to 2 a.m. and Sundays 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Order through DoorDash for delivery or call 530-605-0724 for takeout or join us at Roliberto's Taco Shop at the corner of California and Placer in downtown Reading.
Just when you thought B&T Satellite only does satellite dishes, it's a fact. B&T Satellite makes TV easy. And now Doug's making Starlink Internet easy, too. Starlink Internet is often the only way to get connected, especially if you game, stream, or work from home. Most often, there's several devices connected to your Internet at one time, and that requires a great Internet connection. B&T Satellite is your choice for Starlink Internet, and now Starlink installation and setup. Call B&T Satellite for your Internet installation today, 241-3474. You'll always get the best dish TV and DirecTV packages from B&T Satellite. But did you know Doug can set up your smart home devices, including cameras? Just call Doug at B&T Satellite, 241-3474. Don't call the 800 number. Call B&T Satellite today, 241-3474. For your home custom theater installation, for TV wall mounts, smart home devices, and everything satellite and internet, Doug makes satellite easy. Doug makes internet easy. Doug makes TV easy. Call B&T Satellite, 241-3474.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.